We're in week two of looking at traps that we as parents and grandparents or wannabe parents or people that can and should have influence in the lives of others fall into. If you were here last week, I gave you a litany of warnings about why I feel like we shouldn't do a sermon series like this, but why at the end of the day I feel like we must do a sermon series like this. Last week we looked at trap number one, the I just want my kids to be happy trap. If you were here, you know we looked at how it's really impossible to parent to the destination of happiness. Like, what is that and how circumstantial is it and how do you navigate somebody to that, right? But that parenting does require that we parent them, we guide them, we influence them towards a preconceived, well-thought-out destination. If we don't have in mind, as parents or grandparents, again, people of influence in the lives of others, if we don't have some destination in mind, if we don't have a purpose and a plan, maybe a way to think of it is kind of a North Star, which is setting direction for how we will run our homes, the way we'll speak to our kids and discipline them, the way we'll celebrate with them and lead them. If we don't have that North Star purpose, right? I'm telling you, what I tried to get across last week is, if you don't have one for your children, somebody else will. Their circumstances, friends, other parents. When it comes to parenting, the old tribe, if you don't aim for a target, you will, right? You'll miss it every time. So I shared with you the two targets last week that Joan and I parented towards. It's funny, I was talking to my son John this week, and he said, yeah, I watched that sermon. I sent it to, he's been dating this girl for a while. He sent it to her and goes, if you want to understand how I was raised, watch this. This is exactly how I got so messed up. We wanted to raise kids who followed Jesus. Not religious kids, not rule-following kids or culturally Christian kids, but kids who believed that Jesus was who he said he was. And as a result, they would, when they had their own opportunities to decide what they were going to do, they would, out of love for and trust in Jesus, they would choose as adults to follow him. And the second thing that was our goal was that our family would be unusually, and I would tell you, and I've seen this, to some maybe even uncomfortably close. That as when they grew up, they would choose to be with one another and us over anyone and everyone else. That family and home would be this ridiculously safe place of love and peace and acceptance. Essentially, and I didn't really piece this together until I was starting the series, that, and again, it's just kind of funny. What I was trying to teach them, and I didn't realize it, was that I was trying to teach them to love the Lord their God with all of their heart and their mind and their soul and their strength, and to love one another as he had loved them. That came rushing back to me this week. Some of you know my son John is living in Abu Dhabi on the other side of the world for a couple years as part of a work project. And so we're only seeing him a couple times a year. And so it was my granddaughter Landry's birthday this week. And unbeknownst to Courtney, our oldest, John flew home to go to Landry's birthday party. So she didn't know he was coming. This is a picture of when she saw John walk in the door to the birthday party. And so it just struck me, like, this was our dream, that our children would love one another like that. And so last week, I challenged you to figure out what your parenting or grandparenting or influencing purpose was. With whoever it is that the Lord has given you the ability to lead, where are you leading them and how? Because it's going to impact the daily role of parenting. The concept of parenting with a purpose, I didn't come up with that. It's not proprietary. As we saw last week, the writer of Proverbs, this very ancient book of wisdom, relates vision to successful parenting. Or as the scriptures so wonderfully put it, if you correct your children, they will bring you peace and happiness. But then he relates this correction to vision. Without a vision, the people lose their strength. But happy is the one who follows instruction. Or as I said last week, direction, not intention, determines destination. Nobody walks out with that baby out of the hospital and goes, I can't wait to screw you up, right? Everybody goes, I am going to be the greatest parent ever. That's your intention. But unless you know where you're going and the direction is laid out well and they're aware of where they're going and they want to be on the ride, it doesn't matter what your intention was. Again, it's a well-known principle. In their book, Family Shift, Rodney and Michelle Gage note, quote, every family ends up somewhere, but few families wind up somewhere on purpose. Stephen Covey, many of you know who Stephen Covey is, right? Wrote one of the most best-selling books of all time. He defines a family mission statement in his book, Seven Habits of Highly Effective Families. I don't know if you know that book exists. He says, a family mission statement is a combined, unified expression from all family members of what your family is all about, what it is you really want to do and to be, and the principles that you're going to choose to govern your family life. Pretty interesting. There are lots of family mission statements that are available out there. Most of them are horribly cheesy, just between you and I. But I encourage you to go and look at family mission statements and start to develop one for you and your family. As best as I could tell, as I reflected on how Joan and I raised our kids, we just really had this overarching principle. And I'll be honest with you, some of it came out of fear. I wanted my kids to love Jesus and when they grew up, not walk away from him. I didn't want them to be beat up with rules and commands and dogma and just hate God and his people. And I wanted them, because I had seen so many families spin apart, I wanted them to be ridiculously close. And those overarching principles, they kind of touched everything that we did. Now this morning, I want to introduce you to the second parent trap. In the first, right, the first was you aim towards happiness. But the second is to think, please hear me on this, church people, that my primary purpose in parenting is to raise good kids. It's the, quote, I just want my kids to be good people trap. Or it's, maybe put another way, that my job is to teach them right from wrong trap. Hear me before you start your emails. Put your phones down. There's nothing wrong and everything right about teaching your kids right from wrong and imputing unto them good values. Everybody heard that, right? But what I would argue is that when it comes to parenting and raising good people, imputing good values, right, I would argue that is actually a byproduct of another destination. It is not a destination unto itself. And when being good people becomes the destination, there is a real, and I'm going to show you this, biblical danger in trying to get your children to arrive at that place. Because if it's done the wrong way, what you'll see is it actually, and you know this, okay? You know this. It actually has the potential to take you and your kids to a place you don't want to wind up. Let me explain. To do that, right, we're going to kick off with where we left off last time, with what I'm calling God's parenting plan for his people. It's contained in the most famous prayer in the Bible, probably the prayer that has been prayed more times than any other prayer in the history of the world. It's called the Shema. The Shema, that word, Shema, is just a Hebrew word, and it's the word for hear. God gave it to Moses for God's children, and Moses then repeated it to the people of Israel, God's children, three times, over and over and over. Just as it is today and has been throughout history, it is recited by Jews every morning when they rise and every evening before they sleep. It's that important, and it's that fundamental. It's that instructional in the art of parenting. And the story of God's people then and the story of God's people now is that we misunderstand it, that it becomes values-based, that it becomes obedience-based, that it becomes command-based, that it's about external obedience and not really about internal transformation. And the story, some of you know this, the story of God's people is that despite this plan that God laid out for the parents of Israel, they misunderstood it. And when they misunderstood it and they made it about rule-keeping, law abidance, focusing on right and wrong, and not on being transformed and changed at the heart level, you might remember from last week, only one generation after this prayer was introduced, and God leads the people into this land of promise, the land of milk and honey, this place of wonderful prosperity and happiness. One generation later, the people neither knew nor served the Lord. They forgot all about him, and they began to serve and follow all of the gods of the other countries. So let's get into this prayer, and you'll see why it's so amazing, right? Here's how it begins. Moses first gives it to the people in the book of Deuteronomy, one of the books in the Torah, one of the books in the Pentateuch, the first five books of the Old Testament. Here's what he says. This is what God says to Moses. Hear, Shema, hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. The prayer begins, parents, please hear this, grandparents. The prayer begins with a retelling of their family story. Because in order for someone to hear it, it means that somebody must speak it often, repeatedly. It was to be heard that the God of Israel, their God, and Moses, listen to how Moses puts this. It is so personal. He says, our God, not the God, our God. This is our story. This is the God of our people. In a pantheistic world where every nation, every town, every city, every tribe, every outcome had a God attached to it, God, in parenting his people, Moses, in parenting the nation, wanted their children to know that their God was different than the other gods. Their story was unique. Their story was different. Every day, twice a day, our God is different. This is who our God is. This is our story. So interesting in terms of parenting to look at how God begins to raise up a family in Scripture. This is what he's doing. As you know, in the Old Testament, part of the Old Covenant, there are lots and lots of rules. But please notice this about God. Before he lays out rules or commands for his people, God almost always reminds them. Again, he speaks it, they hear it, of who he is and who they are, what their story is. In Deuteronomy 5, the chapter right before this, Moses lays out, famously, the Ten Commandments, right? But do you know what God reminds them of right before the Ten Commandments? Literally, right before commandment number one, this is the sentence right before commandment number one. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. God does not command their obedience out of nowhere. Now, mind you, he has every right to, he's God. But he reminds them almost every time of their story. Before he tells them what to do, he tells them who they are and who he is, what he's done for them, how he's loved them, that he can be and he should be trusted. Hear, O Israel, again, let me remind you before I go any further of who I am and how powerful I am and how much I love you and what I've done for you. My commands aren't given to you in isolation. They're for your good, and they're part of the story that you've been born into. Again, if you go back to the first time when God reveals to Moses up on Mount Sinai the Ten Commandments, how does God reveal the Ten Commandments? He starts with the exact same language. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. Guys, I did a word search on this. There's at least a dozen times before God gives commandments that he reminds his people of who he is, his goodness, and who they are, and what he's done for them. He reminds them of their story and of their place in it. The prayer goes on with God's commandment now. Here's who I am. Here's your story. Remember what I've done. Remember how much I love you. Remember that I can be trusted. The prayer goes on with God's commandment for his people, but it's not the one you would think. Love the Lord your God with all of your heart and with all of your soul and with all of your strength. These commandments that I give you today are to be on your hearts. The commandment is not to obey God. The commandment is to love God. The commandment was not to obey the law. The commandment was to allow your heart to be changed. These commandments were not the 600 plus old covenant commandments. It was not about for our Father God changing our behavior, making us good kids. It was about love and relationship and heart change and inner transformation. How do I know? Well, the Shema is actually repeated, because it's repeated again and again, three times in the Torah. Here it is five chapters later in Deuteronomy 11, and God clarifies the commandment. This is the commandment that I want you to teach your children. Quote, so if you faithfully obey the commands I am giving you today, what are those commandments? To love the Lord your God and to serve him with all of your heart and with all of your soul. Love your God, love God, and out of your love for him, out of your heart, not because it's the rules, serve him. God's parenting plan. So let's back up. This God is trying to raise up a nation, raise up a family. And he's going, look, here's how I want to raise you. I want you to know who I am. You have to know who I am. You've got to understand your story, where you fit into it, and you have to allow who I am, how much I love you, what I've done for you, and your story. You have to allow it to change your self-oriented heart. The obedience and the values and the behavior are linked to a relationship of love and trust and history. They flow from the heart. They flow from the inside out. But what God's people got wrong then and what God's people get wrong now is that values and goodness and obedience, obeying the law, being morally right, it becomes, and this is where we mess this up as parents, it becomes the destination, not the outcome. As you guys know, have you ever met somebody like this? You can be morally right, but a complete jerk, right? God was not interested in his children and their external performance. He was not interested in just giving them values and giving them laws. Obedience and goodness for the people of God, for the children he was raising, were to be byproducts of something much deeper. They were tied to knowing their God, loving him, knowing how much he loved them, what he had done for them, that he could be trusted, and a relationship. In fact, here's what God's people miss then, here's what we miss now, and here's what actually can be the byproduct of obedience-oriented outcomes, goodness outcomes, right? This is what can happen if it's all about getting my children to be good people, just teaching them right from wrong. Because if that's the goal, if that's the destination, then the end, right, in the end theoretically can be achieved by just laying out all of the laws, all the things that you expect of them. Here's all the things that you need to do. I'll give you the commands. I'm going to teach you right from wrong. And here's what I know. You know, I'm smart enough as a parent. I know that we should reward the right and punish the wrong. And if we do that and we do it over time, the kids will be all right. But there's one problem with law giving apart from understanding who the lawgiver is. Apart from heart change, it becomes a big problem. And here's really it. This might make some sense based on maybe how you were raised or maybe how you've seen other parents raise their kids. It oftentimes, when you raise kids towards this end, it actually results in the complete opposite of what you're looking for. Landry, my granddaughter is 2 now. I've been watching this with her, and it's just so funny because it reminds me of my own kids. Ryan, my son-in-law, he documents the story best for me. He's been sharing it over the last few weeks. He's like, this kid... You know, he was telling me that they were at dinner eating the other night, and Landry will decide, right, if she doesn't want something on her plate, right? She's just kind of grossed out by the broccoli, so she'll just kind of pick it and drop it on the ground, right? She doesn't want it on her plate. And Ryan, right, he lovingly corrects her, says, Landry, don't put your food on the ground. Keep it on your plate. And then Landry will pick up the next piece of broccoli and throw it on the ground. And Ryan will lovingly, maybe a little bit more sternly, go, Landry, Daddy told you, don't throw your broccoli on the ground. And do you know what Landry does with the third piece? She picks it up, she looks her daddy in the eye, has a little wry smile on it, and goes, dupe. Drops it right on the ground. Which I told Ryan is exactly what her mother used to do to me. Exactly. It's like watching a carbon copy come out. What's funny is, right, it's almost as if he had said nothing, she wouldn't have done it, right? It wouldn't have occurred to her, she wouldn't have wanted to drop the broccoli that much. But the minute the law came, the minute the commandment entered her life, it was something like, I don't think so. Like, in fact, I wasn't going to drop the broccoli until you told me I couldn't drop the broccoli. And what the scriptures tell us about, and what our parenting experiences teach us, is that this is what happens when the end game for your children becomes obedience, becomes being good people, when it's about just simply right and wrong, when it's about giving them commands and their job is to obey the commands. There is something in every one of us, Our kids haven't learned to clean it up yet. But there is something in the brokenness of our current natures. It won't be there in the kingdom to come, but it is in us in our current fallen state. It's cute when they're 2. It's not when they're 16. It's not cute anymore. And it gets our kids in big trouble. If you keep parenting with this approach of rules and commands only, apart from story and relationship, this is where you're heading. It's not just kids, though. This is a universal principle. The Apostle Paul, he was a Pharisee. He was a professional rule keeper in Israel. He dedicated his life to keeping the rules, and he enforced them punitively. But he met the resurrected Jesus, and he would go on to write most of the New Testament. This is coming from Paul, who I want you to know loved the law, who kept it religiously. He discovered something about the law. There was power in the law. What happens when you mix rule giving and our broken human rebellious nature? He writes to the church in Rome about what the laws and the commands, but apart from the knowledge of God, can do. Here's what he told the church. He said, for when we were in the realm of the flesh, in our broken nature without our new nature in us, right? When we were acting out of the realm of the flesh, the sinful passions aroused by the law were at work in us so that we bore fruit for death. I love the wording, the law aroused us. Landry would have left the broccoli on the plate, but it's Ryan's fault. He had aroused within her, by the law, a desire to drop it on the ground. Paul goes on, he gives one particular commandment. I've never ever taught you, this is actually fascinating. This is what happens when you try to, this is what happens to your relationship with God when you try to have a rule-based relationship with God. Paul says, for I would not have known, he uses one particular sin, right? Just one particular one, just to explain it. I would not have known what coveting really was if the law had not said, you shall not covet. But sin, seizing the opportunity afforded by the commandment, listen to this, it produced in me every kind of coveting. The minute I was told I can't covet, my broken nature started to go, really? I never really thought about it before, but I'll have some of this, and I'll have some of that, and I'll take her. Parents, if it becomes just about getting them to obey, if it becomes about teaching them right from wrong in a vacuum, if behavioral modification and respect become the North Star, it's possible that you are arousing in your children, especially the rebellious ones. Trust me, I have 4 kids. Some of them were easy as pie, right? Like you just said something and they just did it, right? Some of them, it was just easy. Others, including Landry's mom, not so much. I told them what not to do. They wanted to do it more. Friends, if you miss the narrative part of parenting, of getting them to understand who God is, or in this example, who you are, what your relationship is, how you love them, what you've done for them. If you miss the narrative part of parenting, of getting them to understand who God is and what he's done for them, who you are, where they've come from, how they fit into a bigger story, if you don't soften their hearts with reminders of that story, of God's story and your story, but you just keep giving them rules to follow because you've got a product in mind that you want at the end, it is very likely you will harden their hearts towards both God and you. And it is very likely that when they get old enough, they will walk away from him, and at one level or another, they will walk away from you. So what do you do? Because I want good kids. I want my kids to know right from wrong. You know, I'm just trying my best. I'm trying to impute values to them. Well, the prayer continues. God tells Moses to tell the people, impress them on your children. Impress what on your children? The commands. What were the commands? To love the Lord your God, to love their God, the one who had brought their parents and grandparents out of Egypt. Impress on them how he loved them. Impress on them how he came through for them. Impress on them how he was so good to them. Impress on them about how he used to make manna for us when we had nothing to eat every day. Impress upon them their ancient stories about the Lord your God, our God, opened the Red Sea so that we might escape. impress on them the love for this God, their God, our God, on their children. How do you do that? He goes on, talk about them. You do this with your kids, right?
I can't read my own sermon.
How do you talk about it with them? You do it with your kids, right? You do with your kids what God is doing with them in this prayer. You talk to them, you speak to them out loud so that they can hear. You shema this over them, over and over and over and over in every aspect of life. How does this relate to God? How does this relate to our story? Always with that end game in mind, that purpose in mind. Where are we going? How are we trying to get there? Why is this important? Over and over and again. Their God, their story. When do you do this? Like when you go to church on Sunday? No. God continues. Talk about these things when you sit at home and when you walk along the road and when you lie down and when you get up. You tell them of their God. You remind them of their story. Not just set aside in religious times. Those are good. There's nothing wrong with them. But there is something in this prayer much more powerful. You do it every day. In times of joy and success, in times of pain, in times of tears, on the way to the bus stop, in the car ride home, when you're watching TV, when you're playing in the park, when they hit a home run, when they strike out, when they're 4 and when they're 24. You never stop reminding them of who they are and what their God has done for them, what their story is, how they fit into it. I'm still doing this. Some of this stuff, like if you allow the Lord to work in your heart and transform your heart a little bit, you'll begin to do these things quite naturally. I realized this week I'm still doing this. My daughter Caroline competes in track. When she has a bad race, we talk about it. What God's done in the past, what God's doing in the future, how this fits into her story. Courtney and Ryan are suddenly they're going to be a family of 3 in a few months, and so they're trying to find a house. And they keep, has anybody looked for a house lately? They just keep lobbing in ridiculously over-asking priced offers, and they keep getting rejected. And there was one the other day that they really wanted, and Courtney and I were talking about it, and I said, Court, you remember how God, she lives in a townhouse now, remember how God led you to that townhouse? And look what he did. Look at, because you have that townhouse right now, you have some equity in that house that's going to allow you to get into another house. And so I understand that you really wanted that house. But I'm telling you, the God that did that for you is the same God that you can trust. He is involved in what's going on in your everyday life. I don't know what it's going to mean for the house to come, but I'm telling you, this is who he is, and this is your story, and this is how it paints the picture for the future. We talked about it last week. Happens all the time. Now, what comes next in the prayer is super interesting and super dangerous. This is how we can misapply the prayer. God goes on, and again, this is all for how you raise your children, this prayer. Speaking of these commandments, to know God, to know their story, to love him, to serve him, Moses says from God, you should tie these commands, right, as symbols on your hands and bind them on your foreheads. Since ancient times, Jews have practiced a tradition of using phylacteries, small leather boxes that contain portions of the law of Moses that are strapped to their wrist, right? And to kind of a headband so that they literally, and you can see this in certain Jewish communities, they are to this day literally still strapped to the wrist and sort of before their eyes on this headband. Which I think is cool, I guess. It's beautifully symbolic. Until it's no longer symbolic. Until that became the North Star. It's possible that when God was giving this teaching, he was speaking literally, but here is what we definitely know. He was definitely speaking figuratively. The people were to be clothed in the commands. They were to wear them, maybe literally, but definitively, figuratively. They were to live them out. But God's people made them about their dress and about their outward appearance and not their inward transformation. Jesus actually addresses this exact thing. He's speaking of the Pharisees in Matthew 23. He says, everything they do is for people to see. They make their phylacteries wide and tassels on their garments long. Why would the Pharisees make their tassels long? Well, the Lord said to Moses, speak to the Israelites and say to them, throughout the generations to come, you're to make tassels on the corners of your garments with a blue cord on each tassel. You will have these tassels to look at, and so you will remember all the commands of the Lord. What was it about? What were these things about? It was about remembering who he is, who they were, where they fit in the story. That you may obey them and not prostitute yourselves by chasing after the lusts of your own hearts. It was about heart transformation. And eyes. Then you will remember to obey all of my commands and be consecrated to your God. And what does he end it with? The same thing he usually begins it with. Here it is again. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt to be your God. I am the Lord your God. God was not really interested in how they dressed, at least not in this one commandment. This was about them remembering who he was, remembering their story, what he had done, how he had loved them. And in knowing him and their story, they would be able to overcome the lusts of their own heart. Isn't this what we want for our, it's what I wanted for my children. Isn't this what you want for your children? Because if you're just teaching them right from wrong, if you're just giving them commandments and rules, I'm just telling you, it's not going to change them. God wants them to know him and to love him and to trust him. And that comes by knowing their story, who he is, what he's done, and how they fit in. That's the truth. But God's people then and God's people now miss it. In fact, they used it then, we use it now, for wrong purposes. We use it so that people can see these things and they can give us some a level of power or prestige or parenting clout. Look at my children. The prayer continues, write them on the door frames of your house and on your gates. There is, some of you know this, a Jewish tradition of placing a mezuzah on the doorpost. Give me a correct, there it is, on the doorpost of your house, right? It is a small piece of parchment that contains the opening line of the Shema, Hear, O Israel, the Lord your God is one, right? The parchment is folded, rolled, it's placed in a small case, it's attached to the right side of the doorway of a home at shoulder height. Tradition dictates that it be placed within 30 days of moving into a new home. Again, wonderfully symbolic. Until it isn't. Until the command is not to remember and love, but merely to obey. And obey, the Jews did. Every doorpost had one. Every robe had a tassel. And every Jew in the promised land forgot God and walked away one generation after this prayer was given. The parents missed the boat. They made keeping the law, obeying the commandments, the end game. They were worried about how their kids looked, how their homes were decorated. They worried about what other people thought. They worried about what their kids did instead of who their kids were. And they lost them, all of them. I've quoted for you all over the last year many times what I've seen is the most profound study on parenting in my lifetime. And its conclusion is that the Shema works. For 24 years, Dr. Christian Smith, he's the director of the Center for Study of Religion and Society at the University of Notre Dame. He and his team of researchers have been studying the religious practices of teens and young adults. This book, Handing Down the Faith, it's an academic book. If you're into academic language, it might be interesting for you, but there's a lot of stuff online that kind of goes through what its results are. Right? Here's his overarching conclusion. Quote, the good news is that among all possible influences, parents exert far and away the greatest influence on their children's religious outcomes. Stated differently, the bad news is that nearly all human responsibility for the religious trajectory of children's lives falls on their parents' shoulders. The empirical evidence is clear. In almost every case, no other institution or program comes close to shaping youth religiously as their parents do. Not religious congregations, youth groups, faith-based schools, missions and service trips, summer camps, Sunday school, youth ministers, or anything else. I love Mike, but apparently he doesn't matter. Not completely true. These influences can reinforce the influence of parents, but almost never do they surpass or override it. What makes every other influence pale in virtual insignificance is the importance of the religious practices of American parents in their, listen to this, in their ordinary lives. Not only on holy days, but every day throughout weeks and years. He goes on, America's youth who have grown up to be religiously committed always had parents, almost always had parents who were very religiously committed. Successfully passing on faith is by no means guaranteed. Overcomes very widely. Children choose their own lives. But setting aside exceptional cases, what is nearly guaranteed is that American parents who are not especially committed, attentive, and intentional, if you do not parent with a purpose, if you do not parent towards a destination, if you are not committed, attentive, and intentional in passing on your faith, you will produce children who are less religious than you are, if religious at all. I encourage you to go check these things out, but here were the three top ways that parents, grandparents, and people of influence in the lives of others can do what God was trying to do with the Shema. This is how you live out the Shema with your children. There were three things: walk the talk, talk the walk, walk with others. Walk the talk, don't be a hypocrite. Values are caught, right? Faith is like values, they're caught and not taught. Your kids' faith, your kids' values, they're likely never to exceed your own. You create the glass ceiling. If you say one thing and you live out another, it will not take root in their lives. They will only love and serve God likely to the level they see you love and serve God in your everyday life. For Joan and I, right, our other destination was love for one another. My kids, this is true, I've been reflecting on it all week. My kids are only going to love and serve each other to the extent that they watch and see Joan and I love and serve our families, our extended families, our parents, my brothers and sisters, Joan's brothers and sisters. If you want your kids to live, to love and to forgive and enjoy one another, then you need to model it with your brothers and sisters. Show them over and over, year after year, decade after decade, how to love and to honor and to forgive and to overlook and to enjoy their brothers and sisters. Speak about yours, how you would want your kids to speak about each other. Spend as much time with them as you want your kids to spend with each other. I'll give you another one. Speak, right? Treat and speak and value and honor your mom and dad and your mother-in-law and your father-in-law the way you want your kids to speak and value and honor you. You have to walk the talk. You can't just say it. Words are almost with children utterly meaningless. You have to model it. In fact, I would tell you words without actions are dangerous because they'll walk away. The second is that I encourage you to talk the walk. In the everyday, this is the Shema, when you sit down and rise up. Now, this is where I'll get myself in trouble, but I encourage you, try not to make it all religious-y. Family devotions are great. They're great, I encourage you to do them. Joan and I were never any good at them. But everyday life is better. That is the story of this prayer. Everyday life is better. God, over and over and over again, before he gives the commands, he reminds his people of who he is and who they are. They are part of something bigger. They hold a place in his story. Whatever you decide your parenting purpose is, whatever your North Star is, your destination, it needs to be taught to them the way God was teaching his children. Remind them of who he is and what he's done and who they are and where they're going and what their history is. Don't just give them rules and commands. I'm telling you, they will go in the wrong direction. Now, I did this, I'm telling you, I just got incredibly blessed, incredibly lucky. The Lord just gave me some concepts. Dumb luck, or maybe I was akin, hopefully I was akin to hearing where the Lord was leading. But I started something with my kids when they were young. It was called Remember the Name. If you know my family story, this is a story. I would tell my kids this every morning. John and I were laughing about it yesterday. Every day when they would go to school, I would say to them, I said, listen, none of your grandparents even went to high school. You have been given a great gift. One of your grandfathers owned an ice cream store. The other one worked in the Whisk Scissor Factory. And they busted their butts to give you the opportunity you had. I want you to remember all of the things. Think about your grandfather. I tell him about my dad. Your grandfather, he went to school. He got his undergraduate degree at night while raising four kids. And I would just go this thing, remember the name, remember the name. Over and over. I gave this speech. I would just change it up every day a little bit different, right? Just a little bit of the story, a twist the story a little bit each time. Remember the name. Talk about family, right? And then I would talk about the God story, right? They know the story over and over. They've heard it a million times. Mom grew up in a family of faith, and dad met mom, and God brought them together, and dad began to follow Jesus. Some of you know the story about when Caleb was 2 years old. We moved into our new house that had a pool in the backyard, and I was up on the cul-de-sac a couple of houses away playing with the older two kids, and I heard Caleb scream, and I said, well, let me go check on this. I went inside. I thought he was with Joan, and Joan thought he was with me, and to make a very long story short, I began running around the house looking for him, and when I looked out at the pool, we had just moved into his house, Caleb's toy was just sitting on the solar cover. So I ran out there, I pulled the solar cover back, and there was my son at the bottom of the pool. Now, if you know anything about drowning deaths, it's called the silent death, because children make no sound when they go under the water. Somehow God allowed Caleb to scream loud enough that his father heard him two houses away, three houses away, up the road. I found him after, who knows, I mean, several minutes under the water, and I pulled him out, and he breathed. My kids heard that story all the time. Remember when God saved Caleb? And we talked about Caroline. Caroline was born with a hernia. And it was the classic hernia a child is born with. They said, when they're 1 year old, we fix it. We don't want to do surgery on an infant. Bring her back at 1 year old. Brought her back at 1 year old. Doctor came in. He goes, here it is. It's right here. This is the perfect clinical hernia. Let me go. It's a teaching hospital. Let me go get the interns. I'm going to show them this perfect clinical hernia. Went over in the corner. I've been praying about this. I said, Lord, please, Lord, if there's any way, I really don't want this little girl to have surgery. Doctor comes back in, brings all the young interns in. Let me show you the classic hernia in a child. It's gone. Looks at them and goes, I don't know what happened to it. And I said, I have an idea what might have happened to it. I said, I know this is going to sound crazy, but I've been over here praying like crazy that it would go away. And he goes, well, bring her back next year. Never came back again. My kids heard that story over and over again, right? It was even crazy stories. Courtney had a bunny one time. And the bunny got let out of the house. This is a white floppy-eared rabbit. And it was gone for several days. Do you know what happens to white floppy-eared rabbits when they get out and they're in the woods, right? And so I'm at an elder meeting one night, and Joan goes out on the porch and she begins to pray, Lord, if there's any way that this rabbit could come back. It's a completely true story. Joan opens her eyes, the rabbit's on the deck. Days later, kids heard the story. Oh, remember when God saved Bunny? Right? Over and over and over again. It became such a big deal that my son was given the opportunity to give his speech at his high school graduation. The title of his speech, Remember the Name. Remember the Name. Remember the Name. This is the prayer of the Shema. Now, can I tell you, I got to get out of here, but one thing we're not good at is identifying our parental screw-ups. What I know we always do is we hear parenting advice and we go, I did that, I did that, I did that, I do that too, right? Like, I did that, I did that. So I'm going to try to tell you every week something I screwed up. So maybe you'll think worse of me. I don't know. But I screwed up the remember the name. Because for some of my children, we're going to talk about this in a few weeks, your children are all different. And when I give that remember the name speech to some of my kids, some of them are like, yeah, I'm going to take on the world. I'm going to crush it. For others of my children, I put on them a yoke of expectation that they were not prepared to bear. And so when they heard that speech every morning, it was not exciting and I'm going to go take on the world. It's, I can't live up to that. I'm going to fail. You have to think through all of the words that you say to your children. We'll talk about that in a couple coming weeks. You have to know your children. And so I screwed that one up because if I could take it back, I would restart the remember the name story and always end it with, but, if you screw it all up, it won't matter to me one bit because there's nothing you could do to make me love you less or nothing you could do to make me love you more. So I encourage you, you have a remember the name story. You have God stories. Every day, in the waking up and going to bed, in every circumstance, the house fell through. Every time, share it that way with your children. And finally, here was the last piece of that puzzle, so important, community, walk with others. God's people were not meant to walk alone. They were part of a family. Remember, he did not say, remember your God. He said, remember our God. When Jesus taught his disciples to pray, he didn't say, my Father who art in heaven. He said, our Father who art in heaven. The final conclusion from the study was you have to walk with others. It was almost assumed in the Shema The scripture, the story reveals that the study reveals that if you would get yourselves involved in a community of faith where other adults were part of that community of faith and knew your children, they knew their names and they knew they were up to in their lives and they could interact with them, it radically changes the chance that you will pass on that faith. I was sharing this story at dinner the first time I discovered it, and Courtney and Ryan were there, and Courtney was like, telling Ryan, this is exactly the way it was in our house. Like, all of our friends, like everybody was part of the church. Like, they were all like aunts and uncles to us. I have to warn you parents, I fear that we have lost our way on this in the modern culture. As parents, I know we worry about social media and the internet, and we should, but I would tell you right now that kids' sports are about as big an issue in our culture, a bigger worry. This is not about church services, hear me, because that would be akin to phylacteries and the scripture boxes on the walls, but it is about prioritizing the community of gatherings of God and assembling regularly with his people. My kids all played sports. Every one of them played sports through high school. Most of them were captains of their high school teams. They all at one level or another played, three of them played at one level or another Division I sports. You can raise kids that play sports and teach them that there is value in gathering with the people of God. Not about going to church, not about just sitting through a religious service. There is values in being in the community with people. If you're not in a small group, get in a small group. Let your kids see you in a small group. Get the small group together. Get the kids together. Parents, I have to warn you. Please hear me, this is not judging. I walked through this, this is difficult. My kids would miss occasionally church for sports, but there is a tension and a balance here, and you do not get a second chance at this one. You do not get a second chance with them. Whatever you do, figure out how you're going to balance this and prioritize it, because if you don't get your kids into a community of faith, there's a very good chance they will never go into a community of faith. And so with your destination, with your purpose in mind, I'm still doing this. It's natural if you believe it, and I do believe it. Once you have your North Star in place, parent intentionally towards it. How? Remind them of who God is in their everyday. Tell them about what he's done. Remind them of who you are and what you've done. Give them their story. Show them how they fit into it. And always paint a destination, the promised land that you're leading them to, that they can't wait to be a part of. And then in your everyday, walk the talk, talk the walk, and walk with others. Let's close in song.